Here is the podcast episode transcript. Hello and welcome to Cutting Edge Discoveries, the podcast that takes you on a journey through the latest groundbreaking research. I'm your host, Tom.
And I'm Jen. Today, we're diving into a fascinating paper that explores the role of marketing in public policy decision-making, using the case of fuel subsidy removal in Nigeria.
This paper, titled The Role of Marketing in Public Policy Decision-Making, The Case of Fuel Subsidy Removal in Nigeria, was written by Agomiaho, Osolomi and Eze Abasili E. Ifeoma. It looks at how the principles and concepts of marketing could have helped shape this controversial policy decision.
Nigeria's government has long grappled with the issue of fuel subsidies, essentially, the government stepping in to keep fuel prices low for consumers. But in 2012, the government announced it would be removing this subsidy, leading to an outcry from the Nigerian public.
The researchers argue that if the government had utilized marketing research and principles, they may have been able to better understand the public's needs and concerns, and design a more effective policy implementation. Let's take a deeper dive into their analysis.
One of the key points the paper makes is that public policy decisions have become increasingly complex, with governments having to weigh more variables than ever before. This is exacerbated by the fact that the public is more informed and engaged than in the past.
Exactly. The researchers emphasize that marketing can be a powerful tool for governments to better understand their customers, in this case, the Nigerian public. Marketing research in particular can provide crucial insights to inform policy decisions.
However, the paper notes that there is often an underutilization of marketing research in public policy decision-making. Policymakers frequently don't have the time or resources to conduct in-depth research on what the public really wants and needs.
This seems to be what happened with the fuel subsidy removal in Nigeria. The government moved forward with the policy without fully understanding the public's perspectives and concerns. Let's walk through how that played out.
The rationale behind the fuel subsidy removal was that it would help eliminate corruption and excess profiteering in the petroleum industry. The government also claimed it would free up funds to invest in infrastructure and social services.
But as the paper describes, the public had a very different view. Many Nigerians saw cheap fuel as one of the only benefits they got from the country's oil wealth, and they were outraged at the prospect of losing that.
Exactly. There was a widespread perception that the policy would only further burden the already economically disadvantaged masses, leading to skyrocketing costs of living. People were concerned about the impact on inflation, transportation, food prices, school fees, and more.
The paper highlights how the policy sparked massive protests and a nationwide strike that severely crippled the Nigerian economy. Estimates suggest the strikes cost the country over $600 million per day.
Clearly, the government had misjudged the public's response. And as the researchers argue, utilizing marketing research could have helped them anticipate these issues and design a more effective policy implementation.
For example, the paper outlines key questions the government should have addressed through marketing research. Who are the opponents of the policy? What are the best ways to communicate and justify the changes? What infrastructure needs to be in place first to support the public?
Absolutely. The researchers emphasize that good public policy should be based on a thorough understanding of the target population's needs, goals, and concerns, not just the government's own objectives.
And it's not just about gathering data. The paper stresses that the research needs to be objective, ethical, and effectively communicated to policymakers. Marketing expertise can play a crucial role in translating complex findings into actionable insights.
You know, one of the interesting points the paper makes is that policymakers often fall into three different frameworks when making decisions: the rational model, the incremental model, and the political model.
That's right. In this case, the researchers argue the Nigerian government seemed to be operating more from a political framework, focused on winning support for the preferred course of action rather than truly understanding public needs.
Whereas a more marketing-oriented, incremental approach, gradually building consensus and addressing stakeholder concerns, could have led to a much smoother implementation. The paper suggests countries like Niger and Ghana had more success with fuel subsidy removal by taking this kind of phased, consultative approach.
Absolutely. The key takeaway seems to be that effective public policy requires going beyond just the government's own priorities. Truly understanding and serving the customer, the public, is essential. And marketing research and principles can be invaluable tools to achieve that.
Definitely. This paper highlights how complex and high-stakes public policy decisions can be, and the importance of grounding them in rigorous, objective analysis of public needs and perspectives. It's a great example of how cross-disciplinary expertise, like merging marketing and policymaking, can lead to more impactful solutions.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the role of marketing in public policy decision-making. Be sure to check out the full paper for an even more detailed exploration of this fascinating case study.
Until next time, keep exploring the cutting edge of research with us here at Cutting Edge Discoveries.
Thanks for listening. Here is a funny, weird, and concise commercial for a new company that emerged from the insights in the role of marketing in public policy decision-making, the case of fuel subsidy removal in Nigeria paper. Are you a policymaker struggling to get the public to go along with your brilliant plans?
Does your rational approach to public policy keep blowing up in your face?
Introducing Polity MKTG Solutions, the one-stop shop for turning your policy nightmares into public cheers.
Our team of marketing gurus, data scientists, and political spin doctors will help you understand your customers better than they understand themselves.
Whether it's fuel subsidy removal, tax hikes, or banning chewing gum, we'll craft the perfect messaging, design the ultimate PR campaign, and buy off all the right influencers.
With Polity MKTG Solutions, your unpopular policies will become public adored initiatives faster than you can say protest strike.
Don't let your big ideas get torpedoed by an unruly public. Call 1-800-SWAY-MASSES and let us work our magic.
Polity MKTG Solutions, making your political nightmares our marketing dreams.
Here is the podcast episode transcript. Welcome to the Inquiring Minds podcast, where we dive deep into cutting-edge research and uncover the stories behind the science. I'm Tom, and joining me as always is my co-host, Jen.
Hi everyone. Today, we're going to be exploring a fascinating paper that examines how artificial intelligence can be leveraged to better understand the risks that nature-related issues pose to the financial sector. The paper is titled Assessing the Potential of AI for Spatially Sensitive Nature-Related Financial Risks and was authored by a team of researchers led by Stephen Rees from the University of Oxford.
This is a really timely and important topic. As we've seen over the past decade, environmental challenges like biodiversity loss, deforestation, and climate change are posing growing threats to businesses and financial institutions around the world. But quantifying and managing these nature-related financial risks has proven to be incredibly complex. That's where the researchers behind this paper believe AI could be a game changer.
Absolutely. The core goal of this project was to explore how advanced AI techniques could be leveraged to build more spatially sensitive and data-driven models for assessing nature-related financial risks. They looked at two specific use cases, the Brazilian cattle ranching sector and the UK water utility industry, to develop novel AI-powered workflows and frameworks.
Let's start with the Brazilian cattle ranching case study. The researchers explain that this industry faces significant nature-related risks, particularly due to deforestation and the enforcement of Brazil's forest code regulations. Can you tell us more about what they found?
Sure. The researchers conducted a detailed analysis of the beef industry in Brazil and how it intersects with environmental policies and financial institutions. They found that many cattle ranches are required to maintain a certain percentage of their land as protected forest under Brazil's forest code. However, compliance with these rules is often spotty, leading to ongoing deforestation that can expose beef companies to reputational and financial risks.
Got it. So the key issue is that cattle ranchers may be clearing protected forests illegally, which could then trigger penalties, lawsuits, or boycotts that could harm the company's bottom lines. How did the researchers propose using AI to better understand and manage these risks?
The researchers developed a multifaceted AI-powered framework to assess these nature-related financial risks. At the core is a probabilistic value chain model that can estimate the potential for reputational damage and financial losses based on factors like a ranch's deforestation history, its proximity to protected areas, and its supply chain linkages. The model integrates data from various sources, including satellite imagery, supply chain databases, and corporate controversy reports. By analyzing this spatial and asset-level data through advanced machine learning techniques, the researchers believe they can generate much more granular and accurate risk profiles for individual cattle ranches and beef companies.
That's fascinating. Can you walk us through an example of how this model would work in practice?
Sure. Let's consider a hypothetical cattle ranch in the Amazon. The model would first use satellite data to assess the ranch's land use history. Has it been clearing protected forests over time? It would then cross-reference that with information on the ranch's position within the broader beef supply chain. If the ranch has a history of deforestation and is a major supplier to large meatpacking companies, that would indicate a higher risk profile. The model would also incorporate data on things like litigation cases, regulatory violations, and media reports that could signal reputational risks for the ranch or its buyers. By combining all of these factors, the AI system can generate a probabilistic assessment of the ranch's potential for future reputational damage and financial losses.
I see. So it's really about building a holistic, data-driven understanding of nature-related risks, rather than just looking at one or two metrics in isolation. That must provide much more useful insights for financial institutions and investors.
Exactly. The researchers emphasize that a key strength of their approach is the ability to model these risks at a very granular, asset-level scale. Rather than relying on aggregated national or regional data, they can evaluate the specific environmental footprint and controversies associated with individual cattle ranches or companies. This spatial sensitivity is crucial, because nature-related risks can vary dramatically even within a single sector or supply chain. An investor or lender needs to understand the nuanced risk profile of each asset or client, not just the sector as a whole.
That makes a lot of sense. And I imagine this type of AI-powered risk assessment could be equally valuable for other industries facing complex nature-related challenges, like the one you mentioned in the UK water utility sector.
Absolutely. In that case study, the researchers looked at how water utilities could use AI to better understand and manage the risks and financial impacts associated with water pollution, habitat degradation, and the need for nature-based solutions.
Can you tell us more about how that case study played out?
Sure. The UK water utility sector faces a variety of nature-related risks, from the costs of cleaning up chemical pollution in rivers and streams to the potential need to invest in nature-based solutions like wetland restoration to improve water quality. The researchers developed an AI-powered framework that can help utilities and their investors model these risks more effectively. For example, the model can use sensor data, water quality monitoring, and predictive analytics to estimate the likelihood and financial impact of pollution incidents that could trigger regulatory fines or cleanup expenses. It can also evaluate the potential for nature-based solutions to improve water conditions, and calculate the expected return on investment from making those kinds of green infrastructure improvements. By integrating all of these factors, the model generates a comprehensive environmental score that captures the overall nature-related risk profile of a water utility.
That's really clever. It sounds like this framework gives utilities and their financial backers a much more holistic way to understand and manage these complex environmental challenges, rather than just looking at them in isolation.
Exactly. And just like with the Brazil case study, a key strength is the spatial sensitivity. The model can evaluate risks and solutions at a highly granular level, rather than relying on broad regional or national averages. This allows for much more tailored and impactful decision making.
This is really impressive work. It's clear the researchers have put a lot of thought and innovation into developing these AI-powered tools for assessing nature-related financial risks. As we wrap up, what do you see as the broader significance and potential impact of this research?
I think this research represents a major step forward in the rapidly evolving field of sustainable finance. As we've discussed, nature-related risks are becoming increasingly material for businesses and investors, but quantifying and managing those risks has been a major challenge. By harnessing the power of AI and spatially sensitive data, this framework provides a much more robust and granular way to understand those risks. Ultimately, I believe this work could help catalyze a shift towards more nature-positive investment and lending practices. If financial institutions can easily model the potential impacts of environmental issues on their portfolios, it will incentivize them to prioritize sustainability and support companies and projects that are minimizing their nature-related footprint.
That's a really insightful point. This research isn't just an academic exercise. It has the potential to drive real-world change in how the financial sector approaches environmental challenges. By making these risks more quantifiable and actionable, it could be a game-changer for aligning capital flows with the imperative of protecting our planet's natural systems.
Absolutely. This is the kind of innovative, interdisciplinary work that gives me a lot of hope for the future. We're seeing researchers from different domains, in this case environmental science, data science, and finance, coming together to tackle some of the most pressing challenges facing our world. It's exciting to see how they're leveraging cutting-edge tools like AI to generate new insights and solutions.
Well said. This has been a fascinating deep dive into some really important work. Thanks so much for joining me today, Jen, and for helping us unpack the key findings and implications of this paper on AI for nature-related financial risks.
My pleasure, Tom. It's been great exploring this research with you, and I'm excited to see how these frameworks evolve and get put into practice in the real world. There's no doubt in my mind that this kind of innovative, technology-driven approach is going to be essential for building a more sustainable future.
I couldn't agree more. Until next time, this is Tom and Jen signing off. Keep inquiring, keep learning, and we'll catch you on the next episode of Inquiring Minds. Here is a commercial for a new company called Nature Predict, which was created as a spin-off from the research on AI for nature-related financial risks. Are you an investment firm or financial institution worried about the growing threats that environmental issues pose to your portfolio?
Then you need Nature Predict, the AI-powered platform that can forecast nature-related financial risks with unparalleled accuracy.
Naturep Predict's cutting-edge machine learning models analyze mountains of data, from satellite imagery to supply chain records, to assess the environmental footprint and controversies of any asset or company.
Whether it's deforestation risks in the beef industry or water pollution threats to utilities, Nature Predict can predict the future like a mystical forest oracle. Just don't ask it to tell your fortune, it's surprisingly bad at that.
So say goodbye to guessing games and hello to data-driven decision-making. Invest confidently with Nature Predict, the AI that's in touch with Mother Nature.
Nature Predict, seeing the future, saving your portfolio.
Nature Predict, the AI that makes trees talk, and your money walk. Ominous robot voice, Nature Predict. The inevitable. Here is the informative, entertaining, and detailed podcast episode about the research paper Trust Dynamics and Market Behavior in Cryptocurrency, a comparative study of centralized and decentralized exchanges. Intro music. Welcome to the award-winning podcast that dives deep into cutting-edge research. I'm Tom, and joining me today is my co-host, Jen.
Hello everyone. Today, we're excited to explore an intriguing paper that investigates the complex world of cryptocurrency exchanges and the crucial role of trust.
That's right, Jen. The paper we'll be discussing is titled Trust Dynamics and Market Behavior in Cryptocurrency, a comparative study of centralized and decentralized exchanges, authored by a team of researchers from Duke Kunshan University.
This paper tackles a really timely and important topic. As the cryptocurrency market continues to evolve, the question of how trust shapes user behavior and market dynamics has become increasingly critical. The researchers dive deep into understanding the differences between centralized and decentralized exchanges, and how various incidents can impact trust and, in turn, affect the market.
Absolutely. The researchers' main goals were to explore two key questions. First, how do different incidents affect prices across the cryptocurrency market by influencing trust? And second, how do these incidents impact users' choices between centralized and decentralized exchanges through shifts in trust?
Those are fascinating questions, Tom. Let's dive in and unpack the findings of this research. To set the stage, can you explain the fundamentally different trust mechanisms underpinning centralized and decentralized exchanges?
Great question, Jen. Centralized exchanges, or CEXs, are operated by a central organization and require users to trust the exchange with their assets. Transactions on CEXs happen off the blockchain, relying on the exchange to manage the trades. This trust is typically based on the exchange's reputation, user base, or endorsements.
I see. So there's a centralized authority that users have to place their trust in. And how does that differ from decentralized exchanges, or DEXs?
Well, DEXs use smart contracts or peer-to-peer networks for non-custodial trading, eliminating the need for trust in a central entity. Instead, they rely on predetermined and automated transaction rules. This resolves some of the traditional trust issues associated with CEXs, but it also introduces new challenges, like technical complexity, lack of regulation, and security threats.
Fascinating. So in a way, DEXs are trying to create a more trustless system by decentralizing the process, while CEXs still require users to place their trust in a central authority. This sets the stage for the researchers to explore how incidents might impact trust and user behavior across these different exchange models.
Exactly. The researchers hypothesized that positive incidents would bolster investor confidence, leading to improved trading conditions, heightened demand, and consequently, an increase in token prices. Conversely, negative events would produce the opposite effect.
That makes sense. And for their second research question, the team was interested in studying how the transfer of user trust might shift between CEXs and DEXs in response to these incidents.
Right. They looked at changes in net transaction flow between CEXs and DEXs as a way to analyze the transfer of user trust. An increase in net flow could indicate heightened user trust in that exchange, while a decrease might suggest a reduction in trust.
Okay, so they're using the transaction volume and flow between the two exchange types as a proxy for measuring trust dynamics. That's a really clever approach. Let's dive into how they conducted their analysis.
The researchers took a comprehensive approach, examining a variety of events and their effects on market dynamics, including token valuations and trading volumes in both CEXs and DEXs.
And what were some of the key findings from their analysis?
Well, the results largely aligned with their initial hypotheses. They found that positive incidents, like major partnerships or regulatory approvals, did indeed lead to increased investor confidence and higher token prices. Conversely, negative events, such as security breaches or the collapse of FTX, had the opposite effect, causing prices to plummet as users lost trust.
That makes a lot of sense. And what about the shifts in user behavior between CEXs and DEXs? How did the trust dynamics play out there?
The researchers observed some fascinating trends. When trust in CEXs was shaken by negative incidents, they noticed a corresponding increase in transaction volume on DEXs. This suggests that users were shifting their trust away from the centralized platforms and toward the decentralized, trustless alternatives.
So the loss of trust in the centralized exchanges was essentially being transferred over to the decentralized exchanges, as users sought a more reliable and transparent platform to conduct their trades. That's a really compelling finding.
Absolutely. It highlights the fluidity of trust in the cryptocurrency ecosystem and how quickly it can shift between different models. The researchers noted that this trust transfer was not always linear or predictable, with some anomalies observed, but the overall trend was quite clear.
That's a really important point. Even though the findings largely aligned with their hypotheses, the researchers acknowledged that there could be other confounding factors at play. The dynamics of trust in this space are clearly complex and multifaceted.
Exactly. This study makes a significant contribution to the interdisciplinary field, bridging distributed systems, behavioral finance, and decentralized finance, DeFi. It offers valuable insights for the distributed computing community, particularly in understanding and applying distributed trust mechanisms in digital economies.
Definitely. The researchers really delved into the nuances of how trust shapes market behavior in the crypto space, and their findings have implications that extend well beyond just cryptocurrency exchanges. This study lays the groundwork for future research to further explore the socio-economic dimensions and leverage blockchain data in this dynamic domain.
Definitely. As we wrap up this episode, Jen, what are your key takeaways from this fascinating research?
Well, I'm really struck by the central role that trust plays in the cryptocurrency ecosystem. The researchers have shown how trust, or the lack thereof, can have a profound impact on market dynamics, driving user behavior and affecting asset prices. It's a powerful reminder that even in the world of decentralized finance, human psychology and social factors still play a crucial role.
Absolutely. And I think one of the most intriguing aspects is the fluidity of trust that we see between centralized and decentralized exchanges. It's not a simple binary, but rather a complex interplay where trust can shift rapidly based on events and user perceptions. This really highlights the need for ongoing research and vigilance as the cryptocurrency market continues to evolve.
Couldn't agree more, Tom. This study has certainly given me a lot to think about in terms of the delicate balance of trust and the unique challenges of building reliable, trustworthy systems in the digital finance space. It's a fascinating area of study, and I look forward to seeing what future research uncovers.
Me too. Jen, thanks to the researchers for this insightful work, and thank you all for listening. Join us next time as we dive into another thought-provoking paper. Until then, keep exploring the frontiers of science with us. Outro music. Upbeat jingle plays. Are you tired of centralized cryptocurrency exchanges that you just can't trust?
Well, have we got the solution for you? Introducing TrustChain, the decentralized exchange built on a foundation of radical transparency and unbreakable blockchain security.
That's right, folks. No more worrying about shady exchange owners running off with your hard-earned crypto. With TrustChain, your assets are safe and secure in your own digital wallet.
And get this, our state-of-the-art smart contracts ensure that every single trade is executed exactly as promised, with no funny business allowed.
So why settle for an exchange that could disappear overnight, taking your Bitcoin with it? Trust in TrustChain, the exchange built on the bedrock of blockchain trust.
Visit TrustChain.com to start trading with confidence today. That's TrustChain.com.
TrustChain, the exchange you can trust to never, ever, ever let you down. Probably. Upbeat jingle fades out. Here is the podcast episode transcript about the research paper The True End Procedure, treating trailing zero-valued balances in credit data. Welcome to our award-winning podcast, where we dive deep into the latest scientific discoveries. I'm Tom, and joining me as always is my co-host Jen.
Hello everyone. Today we have an exciting paper to discuss. The title is The True End Procedure, Treating Trailing Zero-Valued Balances in Credit Data, authored by Arno Botha, Tanya Verster, and Rolinda Bester.
This paper tackles a pernicious problem in credit data that can have major implications for how we model and predict credit risk. The researchers present a novel procedure, called True End, that can identify and correct a significant data error caused by what they call trailing zero-valued balances, or TZB.
That's right, Tom. It's a fascinating issue. Basically, the researchers found that many loan accounts in credit datasets have a series of zero or near zero end-of-month balances that trail off the true endpoint of the loan's history. This can happen due to operational failures in the bank systems that delay the timely closure of these accounts.
Exactly. And this excess history beyond the true endpoint can really mess up subsequent credit risk modeling. The researchers explain how it can bias the timing and severity of risk events like defaults and write-offs, ultimately leading to inaccurate estimates of expected credit losses.
The key challenge is finding the true endpoint for each affected loan account. Doing this manually would be incredibly tedious given the massive size of typical credit datasets. So the researchers developed an optimization-based procedure called True End to automate this process.
The True End procedure is brilliant in its simplicity. It works by systematically evaluating different definitions of a small balance that could signify the start of the trailing zero-valued period. The optimal definition is the one that maximizes the difference between the mean balance before versus during this zero-balance period.
Right, it's all about finding that sweet spot, a balance threshold that's not too small, where you'd be cutting off legitimate history, but also not too large, where you'd be retaining too much of the corrupted data. The researchers demonstrate how this optimization process identifies the ideal threshold to isolate the true endpoints.
And the results are quite alarming. Applying this true end procedure to a large portfolio of residential mortgages, they found that a staggering 23% of accounts had these trailing zero-valued balances. The excess history being discarded averaged around 18 months.
Wow, that's a remarkable prevalence. It just shows how widespread this data issue is, even in well-managed loan portfolios. And the researchers demonstrate how removing these TZB-affected periods significantly improves the accuracy of credit risk modeling.
Absolutely. They found that discarding the TZB periods reduced the average realized loss rates by over 1 percentage point. And the survival analysis models they ran showed material differences in the predicted timing and severity of default events.
The implications are quite serious. If banks don't identify and correct these TZB cases, they're going to end up with credit risk models that are fundamentally flawed. The timing and magnitude of defaults will be systematically misjudged, leading to major errors in provisions and capital requirements.
Definitely. This paper really highlights the critical role of data preparation in producing credible credit risk forecasts. The researchers have uncovered a pernicious data issue that was likely going unnoticed, and they've provided a rigorous, automated solution to fix it.
I think what's most impressive is how they've turned a seemingly niche problem into a methodological breakthrough. The True End procedure is a generalizable approach that can be applied to all kinds of credit datasets to improve the quality of the underlying data.
Agreed. And the fact that they tested it on a very large, real-world mortgage portfolio, with results that were robust across different sample sizes, gives me a lot of confidence in the procedure's effectiveness.
Absolutely. This is a great example of how innovative data science can make a tangible impact on risk modeling and financial decision making. By addressing a pervasive data error, the researchers are helping to mitigate model risk and produce more accurate credit loss estimates.
Definitely. This is the kind of work that's so important, yet often overlooked. Data preparation may not be the sexiest part of modeling, but it's absolutely critical. The true end procedure is a prime example of how attention to data quality can yield major improvements in the reliability of statistical forecasts.
Couldn't agree more, Tom. This is a fantastic piece of research that really advances the state of the art in credit risk modeling. The researchers have uncovered a crucial issue, developed a robust solution, and demonstrated its real-world impact. It's work like this that makes me excited about the future of data science and its applications in finance.
Absolutely. This is a must-read paper for anyone working in credit risk management. The true end procedure is a game changer that's going to transform how banks handle their data and build their risk models. I can't wait to see what other innovations come out of this team.
Me neither, Tom. This has been a fascinating dive into a complex but vitally important topic. The true end procedure is a shining example of how rigorous data science can solve real-world problems and improve financial decision-making. Bravo to the authors on this outstanding piece of work.
Well said, Jen. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks everyone for joining us, and we'll see you next time on the podcast.
Are you tired of your credit risk models giving you the wrong information?
Is your bank hemorrhaging money because of inaccurate default predictions?
Introducing TrueEnd, the revolutionary data cleaning service that will transform your credit portfolio.
Our cutting-edge algorithm scans your data and identifies those pesky trailing zero-valued balances that are skewing your risk models.
TrueEnd surgically removes this corrupted data, giving you a clean, accurate dataset to work with.
Ditch the guesswork and start making data-driven decisions. TrueEnd customers have seen loss estimates improve by over 1 percentage point.
That's real money back in your pocket, folks. And the best part? TrueEnd is fast, affordable, and requires zero coding skills.
So what are you waiting for? Call 1-800-TRUE-DATA and experience the power of clean credit data. TrueEnd. The end of your modeling nightmares.
TrueEnd. Because your bank balance shouldn't look like a Jackson Pollock painting.
Welcome to our podcast, where we dive deep into the most fascinating research papers. I'm Tom, and joining me as always is my co-host, Jen.
Hi everyone. Today, we'll be discussing a paper that sheds light on the growing phenomenon of bug bounty programs and how they benefit software vendors. The title of the paper is Merchants of Vulnerabilities, How Bug Bounty Programs Benefit Software Vendors, and it's authored by Esther Gal Orr, Mohammed Zia Haidari, and Rahul Talang.
This is a really intriguing topic because software vulnerabilities, or bugs, have long been a thorn in the side of software vendors and users alike. These vulnerabilities can enable malicious hackers to compromise systems and data security, posing a serious threat. But the paper suggests that bug bounty programs may be a valuable tool for addressing this challenge.
Exactly. Bug bounty programs incentivize ethical hackers, also known as white hat hackers, to discover and responsibly disclose vulnerabilities to software vendors. In exchange, the vendors offer monetary rewards, or bounties, to the hackers. This is a departure from the traditional model, where vendors would rely solely on their internal testing teams to find bugs.
The researchers use game-theoretic models to analyze the strategic interactions between software vendors, ethical hackers, and malicious hackers. Their findings shed light on why bug bounty programs are becoming increasingly popular among software vendors and how they impact the security landscape.
The first key finding is that under reasonable assumptions, a software vendor can actually increase its expected profits by participating in a bug bounty program. This helps explain the rising adoption of these programs and the success of bug bounty platforms like HackerOne.
That's fascinating. The researchers show that bug bounty programs give vendors greater control over the vulnerability disclosure process. Vendors can set the rules of engagement and offer rewards to incentivize ethical hackers to find and report bugs, rather than have them disclosed in an uncoordinated manner.
Absolutely. The paper also reveals that software vendors with bug bounty programs will likely release their products earlier than those without such programs. This is because testing for vulnerabilities and fixing them takes time. By leveraging bug bounty hunters, vendors can identify and mitigate risks more quickly, enabling earlier product releases.
Now, that's an interesting trade-off. On one hand, earlier releases mean vendors can capture market share sooner. But on the other hand, it also means the software may contain more latent bugs. How do the researchers suggest vendors manage this risk?
Great question. The researchers find that while the software released by vendors with bug bounty programs may have more bugs initially, the vendors can mitigate this risk by relying on the ethical hackers in the bounty program to identify and coordinate the disclosure of these vulnerabilities. This allows the vendors to address the bugs more promptly before they can be exploited by malicious actors.
I see. So the bug bounty program acts as an additional layer of security testing that complements the vendor's internal efforts. That's a clever way to balance speed to market with security assurance.
Exactly. The researchers also explore the optimal number of ethical hackers that a vendor should invite into its bug bounty program. Interestingly, they find that this optimal number depends solely on the expected number of malicious hackers likely to seek out vulnerabilities for exploitation.
That's a fascinating insight. Can you explain that in a bit more detail?
Sure, let me walk through that. The researchers show that the optimal number of ethical hackers invited into the program is actually lower than the expected number of malicious hackers. However, this optimal number increases as the expected number of malicious hackers increases.
I see. So software vendors with more prominent products that are likely to attract a larger number of malicious hackers should have a larger group of ethical hackers in their bug bounty program, compared to vendors with less prominent software.
Precisely. The idea is that the vendor needs to balance the number of ethical hackers to effectively counter the threat posed by malicious hackers. More malicious actors means the vendor should invite more ethical hackers to identify and disclose vulnerabilities before the bad guys can exploit them.
That makes a lot of sense. The researchers also find that higher bounties incentivize ethical hackers to exert more effort, increasing the probability that they'll discover severe vulnerabilities first, while reducing the success probability of malicious hackers.
Ah yes, that's a really important point. By offering more lucrative rewards, the vendors can motivate ethical hackers to devote more time and resources to finding bugs. This tilts the scales in favor of the good guys, making it less likely that malicious hackers will be the first to uncover critical vulnerabilities.
It's fascinating to see how these bug bounty programs create a market-based approach to vulnerability management, aligning the incentives of vendors, ethical hackers, and even malicious actors in complex ways. The researchers really dive deep into the strategic dynamics at play.
Absolutely. One of the key takeaways is that bug bounty programs provide software vendors with a valuable tool for enhancing their security posture and stakeholder trust, beyond just improving profitability. As the threat landscape continues to evolve, the adoption of these programs is likely to gain even more momentum.
That's a great point. The researchers acknowledge that while the bug bounty programs offer clear benefits to vendors, the overall social welfare impacts require further analysis. There are potential trade-offs around consumers receiving buggier software in the short term versus the long-term security improvements fostered by these programs.
Exactly. It's a nuanced issue that merits deeper exploration. But the researchers have certainly provided a compelling framework for understanding how bug bounty programs influence the incentives and behaviors of the key players involved in software security. This is a must-read paper for anyone interested in the evolving dynamics of cybersecurity and vulnerability management.
Agreed. This was a fascinating deep dive into a timely and important topic. Thanks for joining me, Jen, and for helping our listeners understand the complex but fascinating insights from this research paper.
It was my pleasure, Tom. This is exactly the kind of cutting-edge discovery that makes our podcast so engaging. I'm sure our listeners are as intrigued as we are about the strategic role of bug bounty programs in shaping the future of software security.
Absolutely. Until next time, keep exploring the frontiers of research with us.
See you soon, listeners.
Are you tired of malicious hackers exploiting vulnerabilities in your software?
Introducing Vulnerability Mercenaries, the premier bug bounty program platform that connects ethical hackers with software vendors in a strategic battle against cyber threats.
Our team of merchant of vulnerability experts uses game-theoretic models to optimize the number of white hat hackers, bounty rewards, and vulnerability disclosure policies for maximum security and profitability.
That's right. We'll have your bugs squashed faster than you can say zero-day exploit.
Vulnerability Mercenaries. Hacking the system to protect your system. Sign up today.
Vulnerability Mercenaries. Turning your software's flaws into your greatest strength.
Vulnerability Mercenaries. Because cybersecurity is a game best played by the rules.
Vulnerability mercenaries, weaponizing good intentions against the forces of evil.
Vulnerability mercenaries, where ethical hackers are the heroes, and malicious actors are the true merchants of vulnerabilities.
Vulnerability mercenaries, putting the fun in bug hunting since yesterday.
Vulnerability mercenaries, keeping your software safe, one bounty at a time.